Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Karen Scatzina, the TIPQC Infant Medical Director. Today's discussion will focus on the rising rates of congenital syphilis. We are excited to have with us today Dr. Walter Dougherty. Dr. Dougherty is a professor of pediatric infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He graduated from medical school at the University of California, followed by postgraduate training at Johns Hopkins Hospital, the University of New Mexico, the University of California, San Diego, and the University of London. He has served as an institutional PI for multiple national and NIH-funded studies, worked as an IRB chair, and served nationally in multiple research and educational ventures. He has written numerous textbook chapters, including for The Red Book, and published research in JAMA, Pediatrics, and Clinical Infectious Disease, among others. Most germane to this topic, he recently served as faculty at the University of New Mexico, which has the highest rates of syphilis in the United States, and where he helped care for neonates affected by HSV and syphilis. We are so honored to have you join us today, Dr. Dougherty. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
We are glad you are here. To start out, I wondered if you could share a little bit more about your career and specifically what sparked your interest in medicine and in syphilis.
Yeah, so I grew up in a rural area in Northern California on a farm. Actually, it was an apple farm. And so we were a couple hours from the nearest hospital. And my dad had it was an older father, he had a lot of chronic medical issues. And I distinctly remember the farm area where we grew up had flooded one year and my dad was on oxygen. And I was kind of scared. I was a little kid, didn't know what was going to happen because we couldn't get out. And a family practice doctor that cared for my dad somehow showed up at the house. I don't know if he took a boat or whatever, because we were flooded in and had some oxygen tanks and a stethoscope and cared for my dad. And so I've always been interested in rural medicine and some of the barriers folks have because of that. That's really essentially why I went into med school. And my first faculty position was at the University of New Mexico. And I was there for 15 years, a really rural, underserved state, and really loved taking care of that patient population. And recently, over the last 5 or 6 years, we just started seeing a lot of syphilis. And we were one of the top two states. And it just struck me how so many mothers had the same story. They didn't know they had it. They couldn't access testing. They couldn't get treatment. And just really taking the time to chat with them was eye-opening for me. They might have required 3 shots of penicillin for their stage of syphilis treatment, and they got the first 2, but then their car broke down. They had no way to get to the clinic. They were working 2 jobs. They couldn't get the time off of work to go to the clinic, and they never got that 3rd shot. And it was just an eye-opening experience, even for someone who was used to working with that patient population. And so that really kind of sparked an interest in syphilis. Moving here to Tennessee, still have syphilis. Couldn't really escape it. And so here we are.
We still do. I enjoyed your talk at our annual meeting this year for TIPQC. That's where we met. I love doing the podcast and getting to know more about our state leaders and experts. At our annual meeting, you discussed the rising rates of congenital syphilis. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about this unprecedented rise in rates that are happening right now in the United States, as you said, New Mexico, but also here in Tennessee.
Yeah, so congenital syphilis and, you know, to some extent, syphilis in general do kind of go hand in hand because the babies obviously are contracting it from the mother. And the mothers are often contracting it from men. And so it's all interconnected. And 10, 12 years ago, it was relatively rare. And I remember as a fellow, we would see a case of congenital syphilis and everyone would come into the room and we had to look up the workup in the textbook and what are we supposed to do here again? And it kind of struck me recently that it had gotten so common, I had essentially memorized the chapter in our national guideline, the Red Book for syphilis, and I could almost recreate the complicated algorithm from memory on a grease board. Maybe 12 years ago, we had roughly 365 cases. I think it was actually around 370 or so, but it's the way I remember that, it was one case a day in the U.S., roughly, which when you consider there was close to 500 million people in 50 states, it's a pretty rare disease. 2023 data from the CDC came out in the fall, showed that it had increased about tenfold. So we went from about one case a day to 10 cases a day. And it's still a relatively rare disease when you compare it to other illnesses, cancer, asthma, what have you. But because it's potentially so severe and life-threatening for the babies and life-altering, 10 babies a day being born, particularly for something that is in practice 100% preventable, is pretty devastating. The other thing I'll say is it's tempting, and my first thought was, oh, this must be a COVID thing, right? That there was a stress put on the public health departments and that syphilis kind of fell through the cracks. Not the case. So when you look at that data and you curve it out from 2012 up until 2024, it was steadily increasing even prior to COVID. So COVID obviously didn't help anything, but this was something that was going on prior to COVID.
So that's a really substantial increase. Could you give us a brief review of congenital syphilis, including some of the sequelae of congenital syphilis?
So the first thing that I think is important to realize is the timing of when the baby might get infected. And so it's a little bit paradoxical because the earlier in pregnancy that the mother gets exposed to syphilis, there's a lower risk it's going to get transmitted to the baby. The later on in pregnancy that the mom gets infected, the higher probability the baby's going to get infected. But then there's this 180-degree flip where if the baby does get infected earlier in pregnancy, there's more likely to be a severe outcome, such as stillbirth or some serious organ damage, because that's during a period of time when the baby's organs are developing in the uterus. And so if the infection occurs, even though it's less likely, it's more likely to cause damage, like a bull running loose in a china shop. Whereas later in pregnancy, the organs are a little more mature, you're more likely to have a little less damage. Once the baby is born, I think it's easier to break it up into two types of manifestations, early and late. And we'll also say that most babies at the time they're born with congenital syphilis look totally fine. So unlike a baby that might have sepsis at birth from, say, group B strep, for example, where they look really sick, babies aren't septic with syphilis. And so they don't have a big sign on them that says, I have congenital syphilis. And that's part of the problem. Early manifestations are often seen, and you could think of this as a somewhat of a simplification due to the actual replication and active infection of the organism. So you will see things like rashes in the skin where the syphilis organism, Treponema, was actually replicating in the skin lesions. You can see liver abnormalities. You can get a severe runny nose. You can have a replication in the periosteum, the outside of the bone, so they can be lifted. They can have bone pain. Later on, you tend to see the sequelae of that. So it's the effects of the fire. So early on, you see the fire. Later on, around 2, 3, 4 years of age, even on into adolescence and adulthood, you see the burnt out house. You see what that damage caused. So you see things like vision loss, hearing loss, mental retardation, permanent bone scarring, and abnormalities in the skeletal system. And some of these things, will, like hearing loss, for example, can manifest when they're teenagers or early adults, which is really frightening to think about. So this is something, obviously, a lot of the stuff I mentioned can completely alter your life. If you lose your vision, you lose your hearing, your mental retardation, that can actually cause just lifelong alterations. And so nipping this in the bud, treating that baby with penicillin can prevent all of that.
So some really significant potential sequelae resulting from congenital syphilis. But I think it's a great point that newborns are commonly asymptomatic who are born with congenital syphilis. I know one of the first things we did in our hospital when we noted the rise is really strive to coordinate with OB. So we knew mom status and knew about her treatment. So that would guide our management of babies. I don't quite have the Red Book chapter memorized. I must admit, I still have to look it up each time. What is the treatment protocol for infants born with congenital syphilis?
Yeah, so it depends. It depends what your likelihood or your concern level for syphilis. So in some instances, it may be nothing. So if the mother had syphilis in pregnancy and was treated appropriately and her lab work looks good, those babies typically don't need anything. Sometimes we will give the baby a one-time intramuscular dose of benzathine penicillin. If the mother was successfully treated, for example, but there was still an RPR that was positive, something like that. The traditional treatment for the likely congenital syphilis, and this is often where the baby either has symptoms of syphilis or the mom didn't get any treatment in pregnancy, has confirmed syphilis, is 10 days of penicillin, and that's typically intravenous. The other thing I'll bring up is that there's also a pretty extensive workup and cost associated with that. So those babies will typically get a spinal tap to look for neurosyphilis. They'll get blood tests, x-rays, an eye exam. And those infants do need to stay in the hospital typically for 10 days. So it's a 10-day hospital stay plus the cost of the workup. And then we'll monitor their RPRs after birth to make sure that they are coming down appropriately.
And this is also a great opportunity to, of course, coordinate with your pediatric infectious disease physician if you have access to that. I know that's something that we always do. To shift gears a little bit, I'd like to think a little bit about racial disparities. 2022 marked the 50th anniversary of the ending of the USPHS syphilis study, Tuskegee. So it's an important time to remember the people who were mistreated. Are we seeing any racial disparities in syphilis right now? And what do you think we as clinicians should be doing to address these racial disparities?
Yeah, we do see racial disparities, 100%. And so if you look at recent data from 2022 that was published, which is actually published in 2022, reflective of a year or two prior to that, but still very relevant, non-Hispanic Black women had a rate of syphilis that was eightfold higher than that of white women. And for Hispanic women, it was about 50 to 60% higher than it was for white women. And you also see geographic disparities, which in some part mirrors that. So for example, in the South, where we live in Tennessee, the rates are about 2.5 times higher for syphilis than they are in the Northeast. And so there's tremendous racial disparities. And when you look at more sort of like boots on the ground interpretation of that, women that had syphilis during pregnancy that wasn't appropriately treated, about 70% of them had no access to prenatal care. And so didn't have the opportunity to get the appropriate testing and the appropriate treatment. And that inadequate treatment was much more common among non-Hispanic Black and Hispanic patients. So they represented almost half of all the women or more that weren't able to secure that appropriate testing and treatment. And so that's, as you said, coordinating with obstetrics is important. The mother and the baby are inextricably linked. So whatever social determinants of health are affecting that relationship or serving as a barrier to adequate care for the mother, it's a barrier for the child as well.
Absolutely. So I think coordination between pediatrics and OB and with public health is really important. You mentioned how interrelated moms and babies' outcomes are. Could you also describe for us the CDC recommendations for syphilis testing during pregnancy?
So there's two sets of recommendations, CDC and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, and ACOG. And I believe, so the CDC recommends testing in the first trimester or first prenatal care visit, and that if high risk at the third trimester and at the time of delivery, ACOG has recently eliminated that last caveat and basically said, yes, you need to do all those testing points, including at the time of delivery. And that's, I think, a reflection bowing to the reality of how rampant syphilis is, and trying to find a low risk versus high risk area can be challenging.
So certainly screening recommendations have been evolving because of the rise in rates. Could you talk a little bit more about the rationale for these screening recommendations? Why is it important?
Yeah, we do have to keep looking. And so syphilis is a pretty wily organism, and it's pretty contagious. So roughly speaking, someone with primary, secondary syphilis, 50 to 60% transmission rate. Depends a little bit on the frequency of the sexual contact, type of sexual contact, but it's roughly 50, 60% transmission rate between couples. It can be asymptomatic as well. So the canker that you might have in primary syphilis doesn't tend to hurt like it does with herpes, and that can be a deterrent to seek care. And you can have a pretty long latent period. So the latent period where it's brewing but not yet causing problems can be up to 90 days or 3 months. And so you may not know you have syphilis, even though you do. And it can take time to get access to care, like we were talking about. And so the idea is basically we just need to constantly look throughout pregnancy to screen women that may actually have syphilis. We can't just assume that the first trimester screen is going to hold true for the rest of the entire pregnancy. There could have been an infection, a new sexual partner, something that occurred after we saw that lady 7 months ago, 8 months ago.
What are the treatment recommendations for pregnant patients?
Yeah, so it depends on the stage of the syphilis. And so the general approach is no different than if they weren't pregnant. So if you have primary, secondary syphilis, early latent, it's one dose of IM penicillin. And if you have late latent, which is latent syphilis more than a year's duration or of unknown duration, it's three doses, each dose 1 week apart. That can be a tricky one sometimes for the reasons that we talked about at the very beginning of the podcast. The one caveat is that we do recommend penicillin only for pregnancy. And so alternative treatments that you may see floating around, different antibiotics, for example, non-penicillin antibiotics, because of the lack of data, because we're worried about the fetus, we do want to restrict it to penicillin only. And the same thing is true for a newborn. We will really prefer only to use penicillin to treat a newborn.
Thank you for describing all that. You really do know this topic inside and out. We appreciate you.
I'm happy to forget it. So if it gets to the point where we can eradicate it, then I'm happy to flush that knowledge along the
way. I know. So yeah, well, let's shift gears and think then about prevention. How can we prevent syphilis? What recommendations do you have for us to work towards reducing rates of syphilis?
Yeah, so many recommendations and thoughts, all of them not necessarily easy to implement, but I think there's many ways we could approach this. One of them is from a societal standpoint, and that I think isn't often mentioned, but that's one concept is stigma. And I think we need to remove the stigma of sexually transmitted infections in general. And we see that all the time. There's some interesting research, for example, that says that folks that are in, the longer you sit in a waiting room at an STI clinic, for example, the more worried the patients get about being identified as someone at the clinic, the more likely they are to leave and walk out of the clinic, as opposed to, say, a regular primary care provider office. So that's something we could really think about in trying to remove that stigma. There's also internal stigma that I think we don't think about as well. So there is some interesting qualitative literature that suggests that many individuals have this internal stigma when they get an STI, a sexually transmitted infection, that in some cases leads them to delay seeking treatment or even to delay seeking testing. And we need to get rid of that as a society. This is nothing new. If you think about it, when HIV came out, 1981 was the first real report of HIV, when the CDC reported on some pneumocystis cases. And President Reagan, whole presidency, never mentioned HIV or AIDS. And that was 7 years, right? Didn't appear on the cover of Time magazine for 2 years. Hollywood didn't make a movie about HIV, a major motion picture, until 1993. That was Philadelphia with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks. So 12 years before they felt it was something that they could actually talk about. So still the same thing. And to some extent, syphilis is one of the big stigma-inducing diseases, and it really shouldn't be. So I think removing that stigma is really important. I think also taking the onus on a primary care provider, an obstetrician, a pediatrician to treat this in your office and screen for that and ask those questions so they don't have to go to the health department to get their STI treating and testing. So yes, there are clinics for this, but you could also do this in a primary care provider office at a PCP visit, screening and provide that testing. That takes care of a lot of the stigma-inducing concerns and access to healthcare that we talked about. Why have two visits when you can do all of it in one visit? I think that also we would need to think about doing some research with mobile testing and treatment clinics. So vans going out to people's houses, going out to various meeting points, you're doing points of care testing, offering treatment at the same time. Those are things that need some research. There's some problems with those approaches. So interpreting the test results can be a little bit tricky. Arranging follow-up can be tricky, but coupling that with, say, text-based reminders, scheduling follow-up clinics in a mobile setting at the same time every week so that you can come back to that site or go to the person for those three doses 1 week apart, make it as easy as possible, remove those barriers, is all going to be really super important. And then also, I'm going to touch base on something we don't talk about a lot, but that's drug shortages. So we have a shortage of benzathine penicillin right now. That's a problem because that's what we use to treat pregnant women with syphilis. And so I think providing ways for pharmaceutical companies to, even if it's subsidizing production of the drug, to create this thing. You don't make a lot of money out of benzathine penicillin. You can make a lot of money out of erectile dysfunction drugs, hepatitis C drugs. Benzathine penicillin, that ship sailed a long time ago. And so even from the federal standpoint, subsidizing its production and providing it would be really important. We as physicians can advocate for that, lobby for some of these changes, and talk about these things. But it's easier said than done.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all of those ideas for how we can come together and take ownership over this problem, whether we're pediatrics or OB, hospital leader, public health. It's a complex issue for sure. I know a couple months ago, I was traveling out in California, and going back to your comments about reducing stigma, I saw several messages about the importance of screening during pregnancy on the sides of buses and at bus stops.
Yeah,
just having that conversation and getting the information out is so important.
Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. a month or so ago, and on the subway there were lots of HIV advertisements, very similar, you know, get tested.
Yes.
And they were in such a way that it was presented as just something you would do.
Exactly.
Right alongside a lot of the other ads on the subway. And so that was really refreshing and nice to see. And that's what we need.
Exactly. Just normalizing it.
Yeah.
Well, as we said, certainly an important and complex issue. Before we wrap up today, I wondered, what are your top takeaways for clinicians as they address syphilis and congenital syphilis in our state, and particularly as it relates to prevention?
Yeah, I think really focusing on social determinants of health, and that means just talking to families and having just meaningful conversations. So as pediatricians, oftentimes we tend to focus on the baby, understandably, but talking to the mom and asking questions such as, so how can we help you access this care, right? Do you have access to a car? Where is the closest clinic? Tell me a little bit about your work situation. How many jobs are you working? Are you employed? How easy is it for you to get to a clinic during 8 to 5 business hours? Really dig into their lives, the nitty gritty about how difficult it may be for them to access testing or treatment, and then providing education as well. So asking, what questions do you have? How can I answer some questions? Providing reassurance. Basically, all that boils down to having a conversation with your family in a meaningful way, not just talking about how many doses of penicillin you need or what dose we're going to use or what the testing schedule is going to be at follow-up, but just having a really meaningful nuts and bolts conversation. And that goes a long way.
I think that's really important. And as providers and as part of the care team, we have that rapport with patients and trust. So that's so important. I know this is also a reportable condition. So again, that's where working with your public health team, they can help to reinforce some of these things too and overcome all those barriers that you mentioned.
And continually work to break down the stigma of the disease.
Absolutely.
Podcasts like this and any other opportunity that presents itself, just keep your eyes to the ground and your ears open.
One last question for any patients or family members who may be listening. Is there anything else they would want to know?
I think the main take-home points would be that this can be a relatively silent disease. It can be quite dangerous, and it's really treatable, particularly early on. You want to treat this early before you see those long-term burnt-out sequelae. You want to put the fire out early before it causes damage to your body. Very easy to do. So with early syphilis, one dose of penicillin, and you've treated it. And so don't be afraid to seek that care in that test.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Dr. Daugherty. So glad you were able to talk with me today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.